complicated issues, and there has not really been one end of that spectrum that's dominated the other. But the digital native thing, I think, didn't play out as I expected.
Well, do you think there's any effect on it being more of a humanities combined with the computers? Or
that it would be a bit more confusing for the students because it's in a humanities context? Perhaps the unexpected environment of being in a first year writing class coupled with using a programming science class.
I think I speak.
Okay, speak up.
So I'd just like to add to that. I'm in Trey's writing class, and I'm also an engineer. So I think one thing I'd like to add is that in engineering, we use a different coding format. So XML was still foreign to us. So we were going into one of the same playing field as pretty much everyone in the class. And
Any other? I know I.
I have a question for Susan. Not really a question, just to ask you to talk a little more about what you see as the importance of bringing up this conversation about revision when it comes to making, you know, more digital kind of scholarship among us in the field. It seems like this kind of production is something that's still evolving. We haven't really settled on best practices and blah, blah, blah. So it seems to me that it's kind of crucial to be having these conversations out in the open.
Right. Well, and also to think about visual media as a place where you can and should do revision. And I'm discounting things like PowerPoint presentations that have things embedded in them. I've always, there's no possibility of rethinking that outside of just, you know, starting again. And the same with art, I think. Students don't think revision is something that artists do. You know, they just, Van Gogh just did it in one pass, never changed a brushstroke. Of course, we know that this is different, it's not true. But the idea of constantly interrogating what it is that you're doing as you're going, and then being willing, if necessary, to just blow it up and start again. I used all of my same ideas, but obviously it was a totally different interface. And interestingly, in the second iteration, I think I chose smarter images than in my first. I had to have more anyhow, but they were smarter. In the sense that they were more provocative of, wonder. You know, wonder's my métier. I'm all about being in that middle place where you don't quite understand, but you really want to know. And I think that if someone can stay in that frame of mind long enough before deciding what one path they're going to take, then that's a really good thing. And that's what revision allows you to do, to look at things, visual revision as well as textual. Allows you to look at it in a number of different ways before you choose your path. It's an ethics thing too, but that's a longer story. Eddie?
This is sort of a follow-up, I think, to Ben's question, but I'm seeing a little something about the dialectic when it comes to visual art. Because I have to say that, like, the Toy Pistol thing, visually, or in as you write, or, the creator is not here for me to respond to, I guess. And so how is that different from, you know, what most people would just think to, what most people would understand as the process of art?
I assume by the process of argument, you mean, you know,
like I guess when I brought up the question, dialectic, like, how could I respond to that?
How can you respond to it?
Yeah, with an argument of my own.
Respond to it with a visual argument of your own. I think part of the meaning of it is inherent in the title of it and in what you stand. It's called American Toys. And to think about American Toys and then have what you end up with at the end of this short video piece is something that looks not like a toy at all. It's dark and dangerous. And that's what that image says. Much more so than the individual images, even though, as I said, it's an argument by accumulation. Look at all of these things we're doing. But I think that the video is much more powerful in that regard. I'm not sure what to say in terms of what should be a response, because visual arguments, as are textual arguments, are just a little hard to get hold of. And I think there would be a large number of people who would just look at that and say, oh, isn't that cool? And that would be the end of their response, and that's one response. But in a rhetorical sense, seeing that might move someone to think differently or to take some kind of action, which is what we want to be the end of argument.
Yes. Question to all three of you, actually, but I think I want to start with Ken, because it's your presentation made me think of this. The electronic computer, we can recognize arguments like kirshaking things and creating interactions, but we also still retain the notion of code as something deliberately hidden from other people, speaking in code or encoding something so that it can't be easily detected. And that, those two senses bleed over, because the computer code is also usually hidden, especially since we move so quickly to what you see is what you get, or a GUI interface. So where am I going with this? In your case, you talked about needing to code in order to achieve certain visual or interactive effects. And I'm curious, do you ever have that code exposed to the interactors so that they could go in and maybe see the code running or change a parameter and see how it might change the interaction they're engaged in?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you make a really great point. And I would say that in the case of a lot of these works, they use a philosophy called transparent interfaces, meaning that the machine is supposed to know something about you. The machine exists in a sense as an entity of creation unto itself. So if the machine sees your body heat, it just knows to move toward you. But the act of coding the project in a way is the act of exploring its behavior in relation to you. So as you approach it, you see it approaching you, you instantly respond, and then it responds. And through the action of both dancing with the machines, often you learn their interface. That in essence becomes a kind of coding, because the variables selected that allow those kind of behaviors to manifest themselves in real time, in essence, become a kind of coding. Is that coding like visible from a back end? Like, I showed you the one image, for example, of the object-oriented language of Maximus P. and Jitter. Generally in my installations, it's not. Although I do like to reveal the visual aspects of the electronics often, because I do find that there's, for me at least, really interesting structural relationships between things like wires and circuits and things like brain cells and neurons and things of that nature. So
I was specifically thinking of the parameters that seem to be at work, like smiling, but I was thinking, well, if somebody knew the code, they could change that to frowning. Or looking quizzical, and see what happens, or distance, and then the same thing with the the code for your Wunderkammers. There are certain parameters that really make that thing, and the interactor often isn't aware of it. And I thought of the maybe how hyper aware trace students are of the code, of the making, of the stuff underneath the surface. Because I think of the text on the screen that's meant to be read, not the XML code, but the result of the XSL transformation, as a visualization. It's a visualization of the underlying XML.
Culturate Trace students to the code. Even though I work with ActionScript and JavaScript, also object-oriented languages that are kind of natural language, I'm not sure that exposure to that level of the code, but in terms of being able to change things around in response to move things, I'm working on that currently. Digital objects, demonstrations of these kinds of things, but with the user in charge of changing size and color ratios, and position, and so on.
When you were presenting your work, and thank you both for great presentations, I went to your website and I was enjoying reading this section where you were talking more about the sort of rhetoric of the imagery and so on. It was really exciting for me to read that and to both play with the project live while you were presenting it. It was a great presentation. Anyway, just
that's what we should do. Everybody should have computers.
Sorry.
Trey, did I understand correctly that so all of your students' work is a corpus, and they have access to this entire corpus at this stage of
yes,
the process?
Yes, that is true.
Which I think pretty interesting. I mean, I've tried doing similar projects, not with code, but where students have access. I know her work really well. I see the video of people who are very eager to interact with a very final kind of product that's out on the stage here. But I'm wondering how, well, maybe I should ask you, is like how comfortable are students looking at this stage of getting in and looking at and possibly interacting with each other's work in this corpus, or do we still stay within our own texts? And are maybe you as a teacher forcing them out into the corpus as a whole?
Yeah, I think Trey can answer the question. Their students and read their entire document, and it may even have comment from Trey in it. And we go through and we'll respond, and everyone can see our response too, and someone can respond to our response. So I don't really feel uncomfortable at this point with other people viewing my code or seeing other people's.
Which seems to be so valuable in a first year writing course because even we do peer review in first year writing course, and but we don't do much sharing, certainly not at that early stage. It seems to be the most important place where we should be interacting, and in this case, playing with each other's work and providing that kind of feedback. It seems like such a valuable part of what you're doing in this project.
And I'll add that there is no one single enforced way of adding to that corpus document. So we get a range of ways of adding to it based on comfort level with that being open to all the different levels of the stages of the writing process, from the initial splatterings on the page to the final product of an assignment. Some students, I'm pretty sure, will still be composing things in Microsoft Word until it's completely finished, adding the markup in Microsoft Word, but then just copying and pasting over into the XML editor. Other students will commit changes a paragraph at how the writing process is put together and allows the students to see what everyone else is going through. But there still is that base level, like Matt is talking about, that you can go through and see what other people have done, what other people have said, what I have said, what people have said to what other people have said, etc., and get something out of it, whether it's understanding the assignment better or understanding a way of writing better, so forth.
So I'm very interested because both, all of you are challenging the culture of the departments that you live in. So I'm very interested in how they're pushing back or accepting you or not. But one of the things that occurred to me about your individual projects is that you're making, again, something much more obvious that is obscured in a lot of other either art or English studies kind of responses to typical text or art. It's the interaction with the actual audience becomes more and more interesting and unexpected, and somehow part of the whole text, the pieces you're creating. And that one of the things that's, it seems to come up over and over again is that digitization makes that part of it become more and more important than even could be coded itself. Like all those people on the stage were interacting in really different kind of interesting, fearful, happy, exploratory, all kinds of ways that could be part of the, you know, metacode for that. So I'm kind of, I don't know if that is really part of what you consider the production of the work, these works, the works.
Yeah, I would just respond that it very much is. For me, it was a very short presentation, so I apologize. What some of the things that I research, or I should say the things I research the most are living systems. So by their very nature, living systems are interactive, co-evolutive systems. Like if you interact with a dog or an animal, we don't need to understand in a way. I mean, maybe we do as children, have to first understand how to approach a dog or a cat. But I consider many of these works, and they're considered by a community of artists of what we call artificial life, meaning they utilize a process that allows them to change in real time and evolve their behaviors based on the kind of interactions they have with people. So in essence, they're to some extent coding themselves in the process of learning from the audience. While the audience is learning, they're also learning from themselves and from the kinds of interactions they have, in a sense. But you raised another really interesting point, and I think it's page as well, which is this suggestion that if we're lost in code, the question is, can we make great poetry? Like, how does one get to a point where you feel so comfortable? I mean, we heard this in Susan's process, and you didn't hear it in mine, but I mean, I pull my hair out sometimes trying to solve a technical problem, because Susan and Trey are absolutely correct. They're never, you know, there's always room to evolve and change and let the thing evolve, but I think it takes students, I know it took me as a teacher and as an artist 25 years in a way to know what I know. And yet I see my class as an opportunity to collapse those 25 years into a semester. Right? I expect my students in one semester to learn component level electronics, to learn programming, and to build a project in 14 weeks. And because those expectations are there, and you know, as with these great professors, I try to, you know, give them as many assisting documents as possible, writing a book to that effect. They actually do accomplish that. So I think some of the issues we have as, and you alluded this to as well about pushback from departments, is that I think that oftentimes, because there's so much to know about one particular area, we tend to sort of silo our own thinking. And in my own department, there is pushback. There's a little bit of fear. They capped the numbers of undergrads I could accept into my program because they knew we were going to become the 1,000-pound gorilla. And indeed, we have become. And now we're like the largest, if not the largest area in the Department of Art. We're teaching, you know, more students than almost anything. So that scares people, but, you know, it's part of the process.
I think you can get the last question in.
I guess just with so many different departments, I'm curious, what are the overlaps in talking about the different departmental silos between a typical English composition classroom and an art classroom? Just, I mean, everything is like rhetoric involved, there's aesthetics involved, there's a composition unfolding process involved. So, are there places where there's more of a blur between them? Are there places where there's sharper distinctions? I'm just curious, I'm kind of interested in both areas. I'd like to see.
Of all of these different mediated ways of communicating is simply changing from the word writing in English studies to the word composing, which also to art, to the objects that we made, including written ones. So I think that our department, it's in the air now to move toward that more inclusive way of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, we've morphed from arts and humanities into arts and sciences. The conversations are opening up amongst the departments dramatically. I'm getting to know colleagues through other groups, or a WASH group, Animal Worlds, Arts, Sciences, and Humanities. I think there's a lot more openness and sharing that's happening. I think some of the problems may have to do with the structural nature of the university, meaning that if I get students in my class, then in essence, we're given we're not directly given money, but the department's given money based on putting students in seats. And so I think this, the university needs to figure out ways of allowing more kinds of interdisciplinary research to really happen, and then also finding ways of giving us some kind of a course reduction, perhaps, that will allow us to explore those areas. Because the truth is that this kind of research takes a lot more work. I mean, your study was probably as an English major, and yet then you've taught yourself to code in XML, and you're a JavaScript writer now, and those are not easy tasks. I've dealt with code, and I know the challenge.
Okay, John, you get the last question.
Okay.
I don't think they're going to kick us out, but I don't know.
I'm a master of physics. I want to point out that there are the discussions of better forms of exposition tools help the reasoning process. There's an older culture of religion that we've done this in symbolic mathematics, we've done this in chemical structures for centuries, and that it is a matter of developing thought processes around tools that facilitate your reasoning, that simplify things, that do, as you observe, become natural, so that you don't have to think about a regular detail. And that structures like this have evolved. There are, I think, some lessons to be learned as to how we learn to cope with symbolic mathematics, for example. That we try to do many of the same things to eliminate detail that interfered. You know, it's a layering process. You cannot work at all layers of complexity in a complex situation simultaneously.